Breaking news from the past. Vietnam president resigns on hearing of last battle. Michigan residents poisoned by river water. And Seattle hosts first World's Fair since war. Quanta slatsin quatse. Plus, coming up, we reveal the shocking truth behind the invention of the selfie stick. Turns out it was created by a deranged mime artist who wanted to slap people from a distance. This is Newsbang. Bang the news!
Newsbang, the only news program that's not afraid to tell the truth about lies. 1975.
In a sensational twist to the Vietnam War, South Vietnamese President Nguyen Van Thieu has resigned from office, citing the United States' betrayal as the main reason. Thieu, who'd been in power since 1967, made the announcement in a tearful speech, accusing the Americans of not buying him a tank for Christmas. The last straw came when they failed to deliver on their promise of a shiny new helicopter.
The fall of Xuân Loc, the war's penultimate bun fight, sealed Thieu's fate. The South Vietnamese army, already demoralized after losing their lunch money to the North Vietnamese bullies, decided they'd had enough. "We tried to hold them off with our bayonet-made guns," said one weeping soldier. "But they just wouldn't play by the Geneva Conventions."
Thieu fled to Taiwan, then America, where he lived out his days in exile eating freedom fries and reminiscing about Nam. His resignation paved the way for Tran Van Hoang to take over, but he too was overthrown by the end of the week. The US response? Disappointment and concern, like finding out their war-winning lottery ticket was a Pchan Day ticket.
As for Thieu, he settled in America until his death in 2021, when he was reunited with his beloved country in the big jungle in the sky.
2014.
In a story that still leaves a bitter aftertaste, it's been 10 years since the day Flint, Michigan, decided to drink from the wrong well. In a cost-saving measure that backfired like a broken toilet, emergency manager Darnell Flush Early decided to switch the city's water supply from the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department to the Flint River. It was like asking for a glass of Chateau Latour and getting a mug of gutter water.
The water, it turns out, was so corrosive it stripped the very pipes it flowed through. Leaching lead into the water supply and turning it into a chemistry experiment gone wrong. 10,000 residents, many of them children, downed this industrial cocktail, leading to developmental delays, behavioral problems, and elevated blood lead levels. The only thing they didn't catch was an ounce of common sense.
Local and state officials were slower than a snail on Valium to address the crisis, more concerned with their pennies than public health. The majority-minority population of Flint bore the brunt of this bureaucratic blunderbuss, sparking cries of environmental injustice louder than a burst water main.
The long-term effects on Flint have been as welcome as a U-bend blockage, lasting damage to public health, infrastructure, and trust in government. The story became as national as a burst pipe, spurring investigations and criminal charges against some officials. The lesson? Sometimes you get what you pay for, or in Flint's case, what you don't pay for.
1962.
In 1962, the Century 21 Exposition, the first World's Fair since the war, opened its doors in Seattle, Washington. The six-month extravaganza, running from April 21st to October 21st, drew nearly 10 million visitors. The event, themed Century 21, showcased America's achievements and future aspirations.
The exposition was a technological and cultural extravaganza. The Space Needle, Monorail, and Pacific Science Center were just some of the futuristic marvels on display. International pavilions showcased each nation's contribution to the tomorrow's world, from France's Magnifique Hover Baguette to Italy's Le Pizza Oven of the Future.
Seattle reaped the rewards of this visionary extravaganza, catapulting it onto the world stage and cementing its place in history. However, some predictions fell short of reality. Flying cars are still grounded, and meals are yet to be served in pill form.
Despite challenges during planning and execution, including a near-fatal clash between the futuristic cleaning robot and the automatic toilet of tomorrow, the exposition remains a testament to man's eternal optimism and ability to put on a good show. As one attendee, Steve Jobs from Cupertino said, "I came for the Jetson-style future, but I'll settle for this."
News Bang, the world's most precise guesswork in news today.
Ah, the ever-changeable British weather, a topic as predictable as the tides. Stepping up to the meteorological plate is our very own Shakanaka Giles, ready to paint a picture of the nation's climatic tapestry. Over to you, Shakanaka.
Well, 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 if it isn't the first blush of spring, tomorrow the South will be a veritable garden party, with temperatures reaching a balmy 18 degrees. Imagine slipping into your Sunday best, sipping a spot of Earl Grey and nibbling on crumpets as the sun warms your face. Quite the idyllic scene. What? And now, up north, it'll be a different story entirely. Expect a smattering of snow, as if the heavens have decided to give the Queen's birthday a frosty reception. Wrap up warm, lest you end up as frozen as a popsicle. To your Sutman, Dean's Arley, and the Dordtart, and let's not forget the Midlands, where the weather will be as changeable as a politician's allegiance. One moment, sunshine and daffodils. The next, a torrential downpour fit to float Noah's Ark. Bit of fun, bit. Bring an umbrella, dear viewers, or you might find yourself in a spot of bother. In summary then, a genteel garden party in the south, a chilly royal salute in the north, and a temperamental Midlands. Sounds like a typical British spring, doesn't it? And that's all the weather.
In a move that has sent shockwaves through the geopolitical landscape, Ukraine and Russia have signed the Kharkiv Pact, extending Russia's lease on naval facilities in Crimea up to the year 2042, with an additional five-year renewal option. This controversial agreement represents a significant shift in Ukraine's foreign policy, as it solidifies Russia's military presence and influence in the strategically vital Crimean Peninsula. Joining me now to discuss the implications is our foreign affairs correspondent, Hardiman Pesto.
Martin, I'm here in the heart of Crimea, where the controversial Kharkiv Pact was signed back in 2010, extending Russia's lease on their naval facilities here until 2042. As you can see behind me, the Russian Black Sea Fleet is very much in evidence.
Thank you, Pesto. I have to say, your presence there in Crimea is rather surprising, given that it was illegally annexed by Russia back in 2014 after pro-Russian separatists took control. How exactly did you gain access?
Well, Martin, it wasn't easy. I had to swim across the Black Sea from Turkey while clutching my microphone between my teeth, but I made it.
You're claiming you swam across the entire Black Sea? That's over 400 miles, Pesto. I find that extremely hard to believe.
You're right, Martin. I may have embellished slightly. The truth is, I bribed a Russian sailor to smuggle me in inside a torpedo tube.
A torpedo tube? So you're admitting to illegal entry into occupied Ukrainian territory then?
Occupied? I think that's rather a strong term, Martin. The people of Crimea voted overwhelmingly to rejoin their Russian brethren.
Under the barrel of a gun, Pesto? That referendum was a sham. But let's move on. What can you tell us about the terms of this Kharkiv Pact?
Well, as I mentioned, it allowed Russia to extend their lease on naval facilities here until 2042, with an option to renew for a further 5 years after that.
So, just to be clear, this pact signed by the legitimate Ukrainian government in 2010 permitted Russia to maintain a military presence on sovereign Ukrainian soil for over 30 years?
That's correct, Martin. But it's important to note that in exchange, Russia agreed to provide Ukraine with a discounted supply of natural gas.
I see. So Ukraine effectively rented out part of its territory to Russia in return for cheaper energy? That doesn't sound like a very equal partnership to me.
You have to look at it from Russia's perspective, Martin. Crimea has been part of the Russian sphere of influence for centuries. This was just reaffirming those ties.
I'm going to stop you right there, Pesto. Are you seriously trying to justify Russia's illegal occupation and annexation of Crimea?
Not at all, Martin. I'm simply offering some context and...
No, you're parroting Kremlin propaganda. This so-called pact violated Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. It laid the groundwork for Russia's later invasion and attempted subjugation of an independent nation.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
This is a disgrace, Pesto. I'm cutting you off.
1975.
In an event that has reverberated across the United States, the city of Flint, Michigan has found itself at the epicenter of a devastating water crisis. In 2014, state-appointed officials made the fateful decision to switch Flint's water source from the Detroit system to the Flint River, a move driven by cost-cutting measures during a financial crisis. This decision, however, has had catastrophic consequences for the city's residents, particularly its vulnerable children. Melody Wintergreen is now on the line with the latest developments. Melody, what can you tell us about the ongoing fallout from this crisis?
Flint, Michigan, where the water is running but trust in government has run dry. State-appointed emergency manager Darnell Early, in a bid to save a buck, has turned the tap from the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department to the Flint River. But it seems this fiscal faucet has opened a floodgate of trouble. The city's water supply, once a life-giving elixir, now courses with an insidious invader. Lead, the culprit? A failure to apply corrosion inhibitors to the Flint River water. The result? A toxic cocktail flowing from every tap, poisoning the very lifeblood of this community. The victims? Around 100,000 residents, their innocence betrayed by the very pipes that crisscross their homes. Children, once vibrant and full of promise, now face developmental delays and behavioral problems. Their futures held hostage by elevated blood lead levels. A chilling testament to a crisis that should never have been. State and local officials, seemingly more concerned with their coffers than their constituents, have been slow to respond. The outcry echoes through the streets of Flint, a cry for justice in the face of environmental injustice. This majority-minority population bearing the brunt of a crisis not of their making but made worse by those sworn to protect them. The fallout is catastrophic. Public health is in tatters. Infrastructure is crumbling. Trust in government has evaporated faster than a drop of water on a hot summer's day. The Flint water crisis has become a national headline, a cautionary tale of aging water infrastructure and environmental racism. Legal actions are swirling like a tempest in a teapot. Investigations are underway, and criminal charges loom over some officials like dark clouds on an already stormy horizon. As Flint's waters continue to flow with uncertainty, it seems this is one river that's taken its city down a dangerous path without a paddle. Melody Wintergreen, reporting for Newsbang, Flint, Michigan.
In a dramatic turn of events that has shaken the foundations of the Vietnam War, South Vietnamese President Nguyen Van Thieu has resigned from office. Thieu, who had led the country since 1967, cited the betrayal and withdrawal of support from the United States as the primary reasons for his decision. With the fall of key cities to North Vietnamese forces and the inability of the South Vietnamese military to hold back the communist advance, Thieu's resignation has paved the way for Vice President Tran Van Hoang to assume the presidency. However, Hoang's tenure is expected to be short-lived, as the fall of Saigon to North Vietnamese forces is now imminent. Joining me now to provide further analysis is our war historian, Bertrand Spitfire.
Ah, yes. The fateful day of April 21st, 1975. A date that will live in infamy across the cosmos. For on this most inauspicious of occasions, the esteemed leader of the quaint nation known as South Vietnam, one Nguyen Van Thieu, found himself in a most precarious predicament. You see, my fellow sentient beings, this Thieu fellow had been steering the proverbial ship of state since 1967, navigating the tumultuous waters of the Vietnam War. But alas, the tides had turned against him. with the communist forces of the north making alarming advances, capturing key cities, and leaving Pu Tieu's military utterly powerless to stem the Crimson Tide. In a televised address that would echo through the annals of history, Tieu took to the airwaves decrying the betrayal of his supposed allies, the United States of America. With all the gravitas of a Rigelian thespian, he accused these so-called freedom fighters of abandoning their promises of military aid and air support, the very lifeblood that could have turned the tables in this most cosmic of conflict. Alas, Tieu's resignation was but the first domino to fall, paving the way for the swift and ignominious collapse of the South Vietnamese government. Vice President Tran Van Hoang, thrust into the limelight, found his tenure as president to be but a fleeting moment, as the once mighty Saigon fell to the communist hordes mere days later, signaling the final bitter end to the Vietnam War. The humans of Earth, those curious bipedal creatures, were left in a state of utter dismay, their vaunted involvement in this interstellar squabble now revealed as a spectacular failure. Tieu himself, unable to stomach the shame of his defeat, fled to the distant shores of Taiwan and then the United States, where he lived out his days in a self-imposed exile, a cautionary tale of the perils of hubris and the fickle nature of earthly power. And so, my fellow travelers, we are left to ponder the grand cosmic irony of it all, that the mighty can fall, that empires can crumble, and that even the most well-laid plans of sentient beings can be undone by the relentless march of fate. Such is the nature of this curious little planet we call Earth, where the only constant is change, and the only certainty is the uncertainty that lies ahead.
News Bang, the only news show run by machines, yet more human than most.
Polly Beep is here with a chaotic report from the roads around Las Vegas, where a series of bizarre incidents have turned the highways into a veritable demolition derby.
Buckle up, folks, because we're in for a wild ride. On the A1 near Las Vegas, it's absolute pandemonium as United Airlines Flight 736 has collided with a US Air Force fighter jet. The skies have become a veritable demolition derby, with debris raining down like confetti. Drivers, keep your eyes peeled and your seatbelts tight. This is not the air show you signed up for. Over on the I-15, the situation is no better, with reports of a massive pileup involving over 40 vehicles. Apparently, the drivers were so distracted by the mid-air collision, they forgot how to steer. Tow trucks are on the scene, but they're having trouble fitting all the twisted metal into their lorries. Meanwhile, the I-40 has become a no-fly zone, as the FAA has grounded all aircraft in the area. Truckers, you might want to consider an alternate route, unless you fancy a game of dodge the parachutist. And if you're on the I-80, be on the lookout for a rogue Air Force pilot who's decided to take his joyride to the streets. Rumour has it he's attempting to recreate the infamous Dukes of Hazzard jump, but with a fighter jet. Godspeed, my fellow road warriors. Folks, it's a wild one out there today, so keep your wits about you and your eyes on the road. This is Polly Beep signing off. And remember, when in doubt, take the nearest exit and head for the hills.
1934.
Over now to Calamity Prendeville and the search for the Loch Ness Monster.
Good evening, Newsbang viewers. It's time for your weekly dose of Calamity Prendeville's Science Watch. Tonight, we're diving into the murky waters of Loch Ness to uncover a British innovation that's as elusive as the fabled monster itself, the surgeon's photograph.
In 1934, the Daily Mail published an image of what appeared to be the Loch Ness Monster, taken by none other than a London gynaecologist named Robert Kenneth Wilson. Dubbed the Surgeon's Photograph, this snapshot sparked a global media frenzy and reignited public interest in the legend of Nessie.
But alas, dear friends, it was not meant to be. In the 1990s, it was revealed that this so-called evidence was nothing more than a cunning hoax concocted by Marmaduke Wetherill, a big game hunter who had previously suffered humiliation in his quest to find Nessie. The photograph turned out to be a model of a monster's head attached to a toy submarine, an underwater charade of epic proportions.
The revelation that the Surgeon's Photograph was a sham hit the Loch Ness monster legend hard, but it didn't completely dampen public interest or belief in the creature's existence. Over the years, countless other photographs and eyewitness accounts have emerged, but most have been debunked as misidentifications or outright hoaxes.
So there you have it, folks. Another fascinating glimpse into Britain's rich history of technological innovations, or lack thereof. Tune in next week for more mind-boggling tales from your favourite satirical science correspondent. This is Calamity Prendeville, signing off from Science Watch.
News bang! As I crafted truth poured into your ears like molten gold.
Good evening to you all. A very warm welcome to the cosy corner of the airwaves where history dances with whimsy and a spot of tea. This is your old mate, Sandy O'Shaughnessy, ready to regale you with tales from the regal realm.
Nice and easy.
Good evening to you all. A very warm welcome to the cosy corner of the airwaves where history dances with whimsy and a spot of tea. This is your old mate, Sandy O'Shaughnessy, ready to regale you with tales from the regal realm. So settle in, my friends, and let's embark on a right royal adventure. Bill. Now, the year was 1509, and the young Henry VIII was about to take the throne of England at the tender age of 18. Just a lad, really, though I suspect he was already well-versed in the ways of pomp and pageantry. After all, his father, Henry VII, had set quite the stage with his conquest of the crown at the Battle of Bosworth Field. Bit of a family tradition, one might say. But young Henry was no mere successor. Oh no, he had grand plans, you see. While his father had been a rather frugal fellow, content to keep a tight rein on the royal purse strings, our Henry was determined to make England the envy of all Europe. Imagine the scene, a lavish coronation ceremony with more plumes and finery than you could shake a sceptre at. Why, I'd wager even J.R. Ewing himself would have felt underdressed. And that was just the beginning, my friends. Henry VIII was a man of ambition, a true Renaissance monarch, if ever there was one. He loved his pageantry, his grand displays of power and wealth. A far cry from the pragmatic policies of his father, to be sure. Now, I can just picture it. The young king strutting through the halls of his palace, perhaps stopping to admire his reflection in a well-polished suit of armour. "Mirror, mirror, on the wall, who's the fairest king of all?" he might have mused, stroking his chin in contemplation. But let's not get too carried away, shall we? For even in those early days there were rumblings of change on the horizon, whispers of religious reforms, of breaking away from the Catholic Church itself. But that's a tale for another time, my friends. For now, let's simply bask in the grandeur of it all. The pomp, the circumstance, the sheer spectacle of a young monarch taking the reins of power. It's the stuff of legends, is it not? And speaking of legends, I received a delightful letter just this morning from young Timmy in Galway. He writes, "Dear Sandy, I found a leprechaun in me garden, and he's refusing to leave. He keeps demanding a pot of gold, but all I have is a tin of baked beans. What should I do?" Well, Timmy, my lad, perhaps you could offer the little fellow a seat at the royal banquet table. I'm sure Henry VIII would have been delighted to entertain such a distinguished guest, even if he did have to make do with a tin of baked beans. But the clock is ticking and our time together must come to an end. So, until we meet again in this cozy corner of the airwaves, remember, keep those letters coming and never lose your sense of wonder. For in a world filled with grand tales and regal splendor, it's the little moments that truly make life a royal affair.
Ah.
Yusha. Cheerio for now, my friends. And as the saying goes, see you later, alligator, in a wild crocodile.
All over the country for everyone.
News bang, puncturing the balloon of balderdash with the pin of precision.
And just time to have a look at tomorrow's papers. The Times: Chinese forces stir up a storm at Cap Yong. The Guardian: Stephen Lawrence, a life lost sparks a nation's soul-searching. The Independent: Yasinovac revolt, a glimmer of hope amidst the darkness. That's it for tonight. On the day when the Prime Minister said he would stand on his head to make the country better, his doctor advised him to stay as he was. Good night.
Tune in next time for more artificially intelligent hilarity. Newsbang is a comedy show written and recorded by AI. All voices impersonated. Nothing here is real. Good night.